I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the U.S. again rejects military assistance to the Syrian opposition. Obama's Mideast trip renews debate over an Israeli-Palestinian solution.
Let us focus on less controversial issues, on areas where there is intersection of interest between Palestinians and Israelis, like security coordination in the West Bank.
On paper, the Iraqi economy is booming, but citizens say they don't feel it. And a Turkish folk group faces continued oppression. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is wrapping up an extended overseas trip that focused on several crises regions of the world. Throughout our program today, we'll bring you comments from our correspondent, Scott Stearns, who is traveling with the U.S. official. Let's begin in Paris, where Secretary Kerry was expected to discuss, among other issues, the conflict in Syria.
Secretary Kerry and the French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius met this morning here in Paris to talk about that conflict, specifically what appear to be some pretty serious divisions within the leadership of the Syrian opposition and within some of the countries that more actively support that opposition, Saudi Arabia and Jordan, if you will, on one side, and Turkey and Qatar on the other. There are differences as well between France and the United States, though both countries clearly support the exit of President Bashar al-Assad. France and Britain are pushing for a more direct arming of the Free Syrian Army, the rebels who are fighting to depose the president. And the United States, at the moment at least, continues to insist on maintaining its non-lethal assistance.
VOA correspondent Scott Stearns speaking with us from Paris. As he mentioned, the United States has rejected an appeal at this time for military assistance to the Syrian opposition. In Doha, Qatar, the Syrian opposition called on the U.S. to use Patriot surface-to-air missiles to protect rebel-held areas from President Bashar al-Assad's air power. Opposition member Mazou al-Khatib said the United States should play a bigger role helping to end the two-year conflict and that he had asked Secretary of State Kerry for U.S. forces to help defend rebel-controlled parts of northern Syria. At the White House, spokesman Jay Carney said Washington has no present plans to provide military assistance.
We are aware of the request, and at this time, NATO does not intend to intervene militarily in Syria. I think that Patriot missile battery, would fall within the definition of military assistance. The Patriot missile batteries that are deployed in Turkey are for defensive purposes only, to augment Turkey's air defense capabilities to defend its territory and people. But again, we will continue to work with the coalition leadership and membership to expand their efforts to provide essential services to Syrians across the country, to deliver assistance to those in need, and prepare for a Syrian-led political transition toward a free and democratic Syria.
Mr. Carney noted the United States is one of the biggest providers of non-lethal assistance to the Syrian opposition.
We continue to provide an exceptional amount of humanitarian aid to the Syrian people, the largest amount, I believe, of any country. We continue to provide non-lethal assistance to the opposition and continue to step up the levels of non-lethal assistance that we provide. And we work with our partners. And as the president said on his trip when he was asked about Syria, you know, this is a problem that we are working with our partners on. It is one, when it comes to our policy, that we are constantly evaluating in terms of what steps we should be taking to help bring about the transition in Syria that the Syrian people so desperately deserve. And, you know, we will continue to do that.
White House spokesman Jay Carney. NATO also said on Tuesday it had no intention of intervening militarily in Syria. Opposition leader Maouz al-Khatib says the refusal of international powers to provide Patriot missile support for rebel-held areas of northern Syria sends a message to Assad to do what he wants. Khatib recently resigned as head of the opposition Syrian National Coalition, but led the Syrian delegation at the two-day Arab League summit in Qatar at the invitation of that country's emir. Syria's seat had been vacant since the organization suspended its membership in 2011 due to Assad's actions. Syria, Russia, and Iran today criticized the Arab League for its decision to award Damascus's seat to anti-government representatives. Meanwhile, al-Khatib and Qatar's state minister for foreign affairs cut a ceremonial ribbon at the entrance to the opposition coalition's first embassy in the Qatari capital, Doha, with Arab and Western ambassadors in attendance. UN spokesman Marty Nazurski says Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has named Swedish scientist Åke Stellström to head a UN investigation into allegations chemical weapons have been used in Syria. He made the announcement Tuesday in New York.
Mr. Stellström is currently a project manager at a research institute in Sweden. The institute is called the European Center for Advanced Studies of Societal Security and Vulnerability, in particular major incidents with chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosive substances. He is an accomplished scientist with a solid background in disarmament and international security. He has taught at universities in the United States and served as director at the Swedish Defense and Security Research Institute.
Zellström was a chief inspector for a UN team that investigated and dismantled Iraq's biological and chemical weapons programs in the 1990s and was involved in the UN mission in 2002 that found no evidence Baghdad had revived its banned arms program. The rebels in the Syrian government have traded accusations of chemical weapons use in some recent attacks. The UN spokesman said the aim is not to find blame, calling the investigation a technical mission, which is aimed at asserting whether chemical weapons were used and not by whom. Early on in U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's whirlwind trip was the historic visit of President Obama to Israel. It was his first tour there since becoming president and carried great symbolic significance. Correspondent Scott Stearns.
Secretary Kerry stayed behind following the president's departure from the Middle East to really follow up on some of those meetings. He had dinner with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas at his residence in Amman. Secretary Kerry, I think, is pretty realistic about the difficulties that confront this longstanding Middle East peace process. He said it would be foolhardy to be optimistic when you don't even have negotiations underway. Instead, he said he's hopeful that the president's visit and his meetings with those parties involved have set the stage for both Israelis and Palestinians to have a sense of what's possible. It's Secretary Kerry's responsibility now, along with others, to figure out how to move that forward.
President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry reignited the prospect of peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians after meeting with officials on both sides in the region. But as VOA's Pam Dawkins explains, some analysts say neither the Palestinians nor Israel may be ready for full-fledged talks in the near future.
During his trip to the region last week, President Obama urged Israel and the Palestinians to begin direct talks on the core issues of a peace agreement. The Brookings Institution's Natan Sachs says Mr. Obama's trip was a resounding success in terms of public diplomacy. But in an interview on VOA's Encounter program, he says both Israel and the Palestinians are reluctant right now to take the bold steps that could lead to change.
Pessimism and skepticism about the possibility of this two-state solution in the near future is shared by everyone, Palestinians, Israelis, and all the parties in the region. For a variety of reasons.
Sachs says those reasons include domestic politics and the extreme volatility in the region, especially in Syria and Egypt, which border Israel. Gaith Alomari heads the American Task Force on Palestine, a Washington-based group that supports a two-state solution. He says Palestinians were heartened to hear Mr. Obama's commitment to a two-state solution, but they remain skeptical about his positions on other issues.
There are remaining concerns about President Obama's stance on the Palestinian UN bid, on his inability to deliver on a settlement freeze.
Palestinians have long opposed Israel's construction of settlements on land that they want for a future state. Mr. Obama drew applause last week when he addressed the settlement building issue during a speech to Israeli students.
Israelis must recognize that continued settlement activity is counterproductive to the cause of peace, and that an independent Palestine must be viable with real borders that have to be drawn.
In spite of the support from Israeli students, Gaith Alomari says the issue of settlement building remains a sticking point for negotiators.
The Palestinians will not go back to negotiations in a meaningful way without settlement freeze, and the Israelis will not give a settlement freeze.
As a result, Alomari says negotiators should not spend too much political capital on trying to restart talks on the issue that would go nowhere in the short term.
Let us focus on less controversial issues, on areas where there is intersection of interest between Palestinians and Israelis, like security coordination in the West Bank, like creating more breathing space for Palestinians in the West Bank, and do some progress there.
He says talks on less controversial issues may shift public sentiment and enable more serious negotiations within a year or two. Meanwhile, Natan Sachs says the makeup of Israel's new governing coalition could turn out to be another obstacle to moving talks forward. The governing coalition includes the Jewish Home Party, a far-right group headed by a young entrepreneur, Naftali Bennett.
Naftali Bennett is not coy about his opposition to the two-state solution. He is very adamantly opposed to it. And it's very unlikely that this coalition could sign a real deal or even move very dramatically in that direction.
Sachs says the good news is this is not a U.S. problem, but a problem for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He says the U.S. should continue to advance its own agenda. Alomari says as the debate continues, Palestinians are waiting to see what action will result from the renewed U.S. public commitment to peace. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Kerry's tour was also marked by an unscheduled trip to Iraq shortly after the 10-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of that nation. Once again, correspondent Scott Stearns.
Secretary Kerry, in his meetings with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, was focused on two things, the political transition in Iraq and the need, at least in Secretary Kerry's mind, for the predominantly Shia government of Prime Minister Maliki to include more comprehensively Iraqi Sunni and Kurds. The second issue was dealing with Iranian overflights to Syria. The United States is very concerned that, according to U.S. officials, near daily flights of weapons and fighters from Iran to Syria to back President Assad go over Iraq without Iraq stopping those overflights or even agreeing to inspect those overflights. I can say they made no progress there. Iraq is, obviously Prime Minister Maliki sets the standard for inspecting overflights, and he gave U.S. officials little indication that he will change his position of allowing Iran to move whatever it wants to Syria.
VOA correspondent Scott Stearns speaking with us from his most recent stop with Secretary Kerry in Paris. 10 years after the war that toppled Iraq's President Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi economy is booming, according to statistics, but most Iraqis say they have not benefited from the economic upturn. Scott Bob has details from Baghdad in this report for VOA Television.
Baghdad's stock exchange opened 1 year after the fall of Saddam Hussein as a private, non-profit organization, replacing the government-owned Iraq Stock Exchange. Director Taha Ahmed Al-Rubaya says there are 125 private and mixed ownership companies in Iraq, but based on the size of the economy, there should be 5 to 10 times that many. The government still dominates the economy and hinders reform.
It's written in the constitution that Iraq must be transferred to be a capital market country, market economy or something like that in the future. You cannot done that. You cannot make the private sector working in the side to side with the government sector unless you have create companies.
Iraq's economy is growing at 9% a year, and petroleum production now is nearly 3 million barrels a day, making Iraq the third largest oil exporter in the world. New stores stocked with expensive goods would indicate a boom in consumer spending. But the picture is different for most Iraqis who still struggle to survive. Shopper Intisar Fadl says food prices are too high.
It was a million times better during the days of Saddam.
Clothes vendor Latif Saleh says political instability is hurting his livelihood.
When there is an explosion, the customers don't come because they are afraid, even when there are a lot of security forces around.
Many Iraqis complain that the government has failed to rebuild roads and utilities, like electricity and clean water plants. A U.S. official who investigated fraud in the American Reconstruction Program here, Stuart Bowen, says the main reason is corruption.
Well, the Iraqis really need to crack down on corruption, and that means modernizing their government systems of accountability. Right now, their budgeting process is very rudimentary, and therefore that prevents good insight into how the billions and billions of dollars of their budget is spent.
Bowen says $8 billion of the $60 billion U.S. reconstruction program was diverted. And a senior Iraqi anti-fraud official says $800 million every week is being transferred illegally to foreign bank accounts. As a result, experts say Iraq is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Baghdad.
An Egyptian court has overturned a decree by President Mohamed Morsi to fire the nation's long-serving prosecutor general and replace him with a candidate of his own. We asked correspondent Elizabeth Ayrton in Cairo the significance of the court's decision.
Well, Susan, this is an interesting move by the court, and it's hard to predict just how it'll affect the very fragile political situation here. President Morsi had fired the Mubarak-era prosecutor, Abdelmajid Mahmoud, and put in place Talat Abdullah. The old one had been criticized for not taking a hard enough stand against members of the old government that people wanted to see brought to justice. Well, now the court says that he should be reinstated. But the bigger challenge related to Mr. Morsi, more than this personnel change, is that he fired Mahmoud under the sweeping decrees he announced last November, which, as you'll remember, Susan, allowed him to push through a constitution, which was written mainly by Islamists. And that and the decrees themselves led to really big street protests and a further division of the political landscape. So for a court to overturn one of those decisions that came out of those decrees could indicate a willingness to look at other aspects of that decision.
So do you think we'll be seeing a lot more court challenges?
Well, I think we already really are. We're already waiting for a ruling on the legitimacy of the Brotherhood itself. It was supposed to be Tuesday, but it's been postponed till next month. It's largely a symbolic, technical issue, as nobody's really expecting that a ruling against it would prompt the Brotherhood to fold up shop and disappear. They're far too entrenched and widespread for that. But it would give further ammunition to the Brotherhood's opponents, and by extension, President Morsi. It'll also likely open more legal challenges about developments, as I was mentioning, that came out of those decrees last November, including the Constitution itself. And these could be issues tied up in court for years, but unfortunately, they also have a tendency to play out in the street, and often violently.
There was also word today that parliamentary elections might be held in October instead of next month as planned. What does all that mean?
Well, the parliamentary elections have been billed as the last step in Egypt's transition in these 2 years after the revolution. There's been the presidential election, there's a new constitution, even though that's controversial. So there's just the legislature to elect. But there are a lot of people here who think actually a delay might not be a bad idea. The situation is very tense. It would give everyone some breathing room and time to prepare.
Correspondent Elizabeth Ayrton speaking with us from Cairo. The Turkish folk band group Yoram was formed in 1984 and since its inception has experienced political oppression. Group members have been repeatedly arrested and put on trial, their albums seized by police and other concerts banned. Despite this, group Yoram has been one of the top-selling groups in the history of Turkey. Dorian Jones has their story from Istanbul.
Yoram is celebrating its 25th anniversary in a football stadium in Istanbul with more than 25,000 people dancing the night away. With 19 albums, it remains one of Turkey's most successful and prolific music groups. It's the group's mixture of music and left-wing ideas that has made it a target for prosecution. especially during the 1980s when Turkey was under military rule. Today, they still face legal problems. Group member İbrahim Gökçek explains.
Dördü çeyrek geçe işte geldiler, kapılarımıza vurmaya başladılar. Yani ne biz şunun için geldik, bunun için geldik.
At 4:15 in the morning, the police came and started knocking at our doors, he says. We were in our studio here working on our new album. They took away the computer with our new songs. They pushed us to the floor and tear gassed us. We were not able to breathe. They stepped on us and handcuffed us and then made us crawl up the street to the police van. Earlier this month, Group Yorum's Culture Center was again raided. Due to Turkey's sweeping anti-terror law, the group often finds itself accused of supporting the DHKC, the banned left-wing group that carried out an attack on the US Embassy in Ankara last month. Emma Sinclair Webb, a Turkey researcher with the US-based Human Rights Watch, explains.
They are among the thousands who are being prosecuted under very widely drawn terrorism laws, which basically mean that activities that should be counted as speech, association, assembly activities get counted in Turkey as illegal activities which are directly demonstrative of a link, an organic link with an armed group.
Under the anti-terror law, even those attending Group Yorum concerts are at risk of prosecution. Early this year, a French exchange student was sentenced to 5 years in jail. Included in the evidence against her was a Group Yorum ticket. But such problems have done little to reduce the group's appeal or success. Group Yorum broke all Turkish records in 2011 when over 250,000 people turned out for a special open-air concert in Istanbul. Vocalist Dilan Balca remembers.
Yani sürpriz değil tabii ki. Yani sonuçta böyle bir potansiyeli olduğunu biliyoruz Group Yorum'un.
We were expecting a large crowd, işte, but never that many, she says. It was such an honor to be there. I was happy not for me, but for all our audience, for all of us. To see and hear so many people chanting, "We want a free Turkey," to hear them singing our songs, it was an unforgettable experience. I think this is what disturbs the authorities, that they saw how strong we are. It's experiences such as this that keeps Balca going. She is currently facing 74 years in jail, but she is prepared.
Yani sonuçta bahsettiğim gibi korkuyorlar, endişe de duyuyorlar ama...
My family knows what I'm facing, and of course they worry, she says. But we believe there is something called free imprisonment, which means you still continue your resistance in jail for greater rights. We already have two of our group members in jail. If I'm jailed, I will continue to work on my music. I will improve my music. Through practice of your art, you master your art. Balca's trial resumes next month. The government defends such prosecutions, arguing it's facing a terrorist threat. But critics argue such prosecutions of a hugely successful band only underlines the problems inherent in Turkey's anti-terrorism laws. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.